every idea that's ever occurred to us, all of our background, all of our education, all of our association with other books of theosophy, and so on, you see. But this mind of the child, which Krishnaji was so concerned with, has its own healthiness, its own clarity. It's ready to perceive anything, you see, anything that may arise. And so this is the attitude that is absolutely required. And that's not easy, you know, it's not easy. If you're going to think about, for example, the second fundamental proposition of the cyclic nature of existence, immediately you say, oh, that's reincarnation. And that ends it, you say. And that ends it. What do you know about it? Can you approach it with the mind of the child that views it for the first time, you say? This is part of the attitude. As I say, it's, the Buddhist calls it the healthy attitude, which is required. Let me call your attention to this statement, which I think is a really quite a remarkable statement. He, of course, Aldous Huxley, called the secret doctrine, the theosophical worldview, the occult doctrine, the esoteric doctrine, however you want to refer to it, by the term the perennial philosophy, Philosophia Perennis. And he defines there the three aspects of this doctrine, which really underlie the principles that we will be exploring to some extent through this weekend. And I say to some extent because obviously we cannot go into all of them. But I like this definition because it does cover the three areas which really in a fundamental way are basic to the three fundamental propositions on which the entire secret doctrine rests its case. And if you're not familiar with these, sometime read the proem of volume one of the secret doctrine, because that sets it forth. And as HPB points out, these are three fundamentals that are basic to this particular worldview, basic to the theosophical viewpoint, basic to the esoteric philosophy, basic to, therefore, the Philosophia Perennis. So please note it, and if you like, underline these three terms. The metaphysic, first of all, the metaphysic that recognizes a divine reality substantial to the world of things and lives and minds. A metaphysic, therefore, that is based upon, recognizes an ultimate reality. This, in the terms of the first fundamental proposition, is what we can call be-ness. There are three little words I have down here, you will see, on this left-hand side of the board. Be-ness. Fundamental is an ultimate reality beyond all human comprehension, beyond all delimiting language. Ever-present, unchangeable, and yet makes possible all changes, makes possible everything. At times, you see, we've said the theosophical worldview is monistic. It is not. It is non-dualistic, which is a subtle difference there. The existence of one, monism, implies the existence of many. Non-dualism indicates that one may emerge. We'll look at this a little bit further. Language is difficult here. And, of course, HPB, therefore, quotes, as you well know, the great Upanishad, which points out that it is a reality about which nothing can be said, as she quotes it from the Mandukya Upanishad, unthinkable and unspeakable. So this is the metaphysic. Secondly, the psychology that finds in the soul something similar to or even identical with this ultimate divine reality. Now, this psychology is really the whole basis of the second and third fundamental proposition, becoming and being. I like to identify it, however, with the second fundamental proposition, a psychology that indicates a progression. It is process, as we emphasized last night. We are unaccustomed to thinking in process. We think in separate bits, quantized bits, which we call words. You see, it's very difficult to think without words, isn't it? Can you think without words? You may visualize, you may imagine, you may create, but to think without words is difficult, if not impossible. So it is a process that we are talking about. So this is the psychology. That is to say, the whole movement of everything, which ultimately follows one pattern. And this, of course, is fundamental to the philosophy that we are emphasizing. Fundamentally follows one pattern. And that pattern, according to the secret doctrine, is the heavenly man. The man pattern, not in terms of, you know, two arms, two legs, two eyes, and one nose, etc., etc., etc. You see, this form, but this pattern in terms of reflective consciousness, which is the essential. So again and again, through the secret doctrine, the pattern is emphasized. And it is the pattern for our system. Now, I'm not saying, and HPB does not say, that it's a pattern for all systems, but for our system, which includes, you know, enough for us to grapple with, I'm sure. We needn't worry about what any other patterns are for other systems. But the pattern is called the heavenly man. It's a marvelous pattern. It's the anthropos. And it's rather interesting that today there are proposals among a number of scientists that the fundamental principle underlying the whole creation, evolution, emergence of a universe is what is called the anthropic principle. Some years ago, there was an article in Scientific American, even, which is rather a prestigious magazine, has quite a reputation at least, called the anthropic principle. That this, indeed, this anthropos, this is, of course, what was the goal of the alchemists of the Middle Ages. The Chinese alchemy, the secret of the golden flower, which is the whole distillation of Chinese alchemy. This was the goal. In all the mystery traditions was this emergence of the little man, the homunculus, as it's known in alchemy, the dwarf Purusha in the heart, as it's spoken of in the Upanishads. So this is the heavenly man, as HPB refers to it. And so here is the archetype, here is the pattern towards which we are tending. I mean, don't think that we are human yet. We've only begun our journey towards humanhood. I mean, many of us, you know, would like to get off this rung, this mill wheel, and get on to being spiritual. But that is not the whole point of it, if I may put it that way. We're just beginning being human. We're just sort of exploring. And that is why mankind, this particular stage, is the central stage of the whole particular present system, the fourth creative hierarchy, as it's sometimes referred to. Central, because we're exploring, we're covering new ground. You know, we're going a way by which there is no path. So we have to become the path, as the voice of the silence tells us, you see. Because nobody's been this way before. I mean, what's the point of doing something others have done in other systems, in other manvantaras and so on, whole systems? We are forging, we are pioneers, because we're just beginning to discover what it might be like to be human. It's therefore all the crises in the world. It's a very difficult stage, isn't it? Extremely difficult. And you can bring it down by reflection to our present humanity on what is known as the fourth round, the fourth globe, and all of that, just a little past that midpoint into a fifth stage of consciousness, which unfortunately got called race, unfortunately, simply because, I suppose, 100 years ago, nobody had any idea that that term would become pejorative as it has in our time. You know, it was a perfectly, you know, a lot of words change their meanings, don't they? So let's not use it, all right, the fifth stage of consciousness, just past this midpoint, the fourth round on the fourth globe. For those of you who are, may not be familiar yet with rounds and globes and races and all the rest, don't worry. You know, you'll eventually get caught up in it. But here is this middle point. Everything up to this time, in a sense, has been sort of recapitulation. But now we're on our own, forging this way. The pattern is there. The pattern is there. But how we fill in that pattern, what images we give to it, is for us. So the psychology that finds in this central focus of being human something similar to, or even identical with, and of course it is identical with, that ultimate reality. And then third, the ethic that places man's final end in the knowledge of the immanent and transcendent ground of all being. And that's precisely what I was saying last evening, wasn't it? That we will ultimately know the real, know it, you see, in the knowledge of the immanent and transcendent ground of all being. This is being, and this is indeed what HPB calls in the proem the pivotal doctrine of the esoteric philosophy, the pivotal doctrine of the esoteric philosophy. Let me read it. I usually quote it from memory, but I decided I'd better bring up a book and be sure I have it quoted accurately. The pivotal doctrine of the esoteric philosophy admits no privileges or special gifts in man. And that's what I've just been saying, you see. We're on our own. We're forging a new path. We're pioneers in the discovery of this archetypal pattern. Save those won by his own ego through personal effort and merit throughout a long series of metempsychoses and reincarnations. How often we forget that metempsychosis process, which is the transformation process. You see, we often say, well, I'm going to wait for my next life. Well, why? Do it now. You see, you don't need a completely new physical form. That, after all, is changing all the time. Anyhow, you see, you're not in the same physical form you were at birth. You know, thank heavens. I mean, we've all grown to a certain stage, etc., and it's constantly changing. But the essential change that has to take place, and this is why HPB, I think, put this word first, is the change of the interior being, the transformation that occurs through metempsychosis. But it's a transformation that brings about the realization of an ethic. And that is why I emphasized last night that the central message of the secret doctrine then is live the life if you would come to the wisdom. Live the life. It's an ethic that has to be recognized and that places, therefore, as Huxley puts it, man's final end in the knowledge of the immanent and transcendent ground of all being. So in those few lines there, that one sentence, or part of a sentence actually, lies the three great principles. Yes, Bev?
Does the transcendent ground, or immanent transcendent ground of all being, refer to the same thing as divine?
I think it does, yes. To me it does, and I think that's what Huxley meant by it, you see. So that it's both immanent and transcendent. And so it is said, for example, even in the secret doctrine, towards the end of volume one, volume one in the Adyar edition, and towards the middle of volume one in the original edition, in a great occult commentary, that even the highest Dhyan Chohans, that is, even the highest lords of meditation who have achieved, still perceive this ultimate through a kind of veil, a mist. It's rather interesting, through a mist that arises. And so, as the voice of the silence, I think it's the voice of the silence, puts it, you will approach the flame, but you will approach it, but you will never touch it. I can't remember the exact words. Somebody may remember the quote, but you will always approach it, but never actually touch it. Because you can't. That would mean there is still duality. I touch that ultimate reality. So it is always transcendent at the same time that it is immanent. Its immanence, however, may not be known, may not be recognized, unless one has the ability or has the skill, and here is where the ethic comes in. And if you will look at the second quotation, this is made very clear. And that's why I call it the miner and the gold. The one being is the noumenon of all the noumena which we know must underlie phenomena, is the reality of all the archetypes, if you like, the noumena, all the patterns which we know must underlie phenomena, and give them whatever shadow of reality they possess, but which we have not the senses or the intellect to cognize at present. At present. Very interesting. And then she uses this marvelous metaphor, the impalpable atoms of gold scattered through the substance of a ton of auriferous quartz. Auriferous, I trust you know, simply means that it's full of gold. You know, may be imperceptible to the naked eye of the miner. Yet he knows that they are not only present there, but that they alone give his quartz any appreciable value. And this relation of the gold to the quartz may faintly shadow forth that of the noumenon to the phenomenon. But the miner knows what the gold will look like when extracted from the quartz. This is what we are to skill ourselves in through living the life, if you will, to become the one who recognizes, will know what it looks like. Whereas the common mortal can form no conception of the reality of things separated from the Maya which veils them and in which they are hidden. We'll look at the whole question of Maya tonight. I think we'll get to it. But there, you see, is this ethic that is involved throughout a long series, as HPB says, of metempsychoses and reincarnations. Yes, we might as well change bodies now and then. You know, you get rather tired after a while of the one body you're in, and why not change it, turn it in on a new model, and so on. But the essential transformation is the metempsychosis, the interior transformation through the pilgrimage of the soul. And that's what it means, you see. But it's done, as she says, through personal effort and merit. Live the life, if you would come to the wisdom. I'll keep repeating that. And so, you see, HPB pointed out in her esoteric teachings, and this is in number 5 in your list, you see. I numbered them because then you can find them. But it doesn't mean I'm going to take them up in this order, as I say. I don't see why I have to take them up in the order. But number 5, this is in her esoteric teachings, and it's a marvelous statement. It's a marvelous statement. Because she says, to understand this abstruse metaphysical doctrine fully and correctly. And she admits it's an abstruse and a rather difficult one. But to understand it, one has to be thoroughly impressed with an idea. And I love this. Poor HPB. This is written towards the end of her life, probably in late 1890 or early 1891, actually, because this is in the third of her esoteric instructions to her group of students. One, she says, which I have in vain endeavored to impart to theosophists at large. Don't you feel the utter weariness of this woman who has been attempting for all of these years, you see, to try to impress on those who were drawn to these teachings, who recognized in this a real gold mine of understanding. And she says, I have tried in vain, I've in vain endeavored to impart to Theosophists, namely that the great axiomatic truth that the only eternal and living reality is that which the Hindus call Paramatman and Parabrahman. This is the one ever-existing root essence, immutable and unknowable to our physical senses, but manifest and clearly perceptible to our spiritual natures. Once imbued with that basic idea and the further conception that if it is omnipresent, universal, and eternal, like abstract space itself, we must have emanated from it and we must someday return to it. Then she adds, all the rest becomes easy. Isn't that marvelous? All the rest becomes easy. Once you have perceived the gold in the auriferous quartz, once you have really perceived it, everything else is easy. Helpful to know that, isn't it? You see. So it's the first step that's the hardest. Well, let us then recognize that this is then the metaphysic, the psychology, and the ethic. And these are the three essential areas that we have to look at. And so let us look then at this as process. Now, as process, this then emerges in what we may call a certain sequence. And we will look at that. But before we do, I'd like you to look at the right-hand side of the board. Might as well move about, you know. As I say, I didn't put this up in order. I simply put it up in a way in which it seemed to sort of fit onto the board. And that was the easiest way. We are recognizing, and I have just emphasized, the importance of H.P.B.'s use of the word metempsychosis in this matter of the pivotal doctrine. We are certainly recognizing today that one of our great losses in the Western world, and it's being restored gradually, is a recognition of the importance of myth in our lives. We all live out our own personal myths, that is, our own personal stories of our own personal growth, our own personal development from within. And myth is really not, I'm not talking about myth, of course, as it's been defined often as simply fable or untruth or legend, but as the essential history of the soul. This is the true history of the soul. And so, you see, Jung early on could write a book, Modern Man in Search of a Soul, this lost element in our being, this lost element in our lives. And so we've poo-pooed it. But happily, we are coming back to a realization of the importance of myth, that we all live out our own myths. Now, there are three great, I'm not going to spend a great deal of time, I don't have it, to discuss myth and mythology. I don't think enough has been done, frankly, on comparative mythology. Of course, Dr. Campbell, Joseph Campbell, who's probably the greatest living authority on mythology today, has done a great deal. But someday, if I live long enough, I intend to write a book on comparative mythology from the theosophical point of view, because I think it is fundamental to this point of view. But, you know, well, I keep thinking, after all, Goethe wrote Faust when he was 80, and so I have a few years yet to go.
Enjoy and quote yourself back. Don't wait till you're next life.
All right. I'll try not to. Thank you, Bill. But I think it helps, therefore, to see these correspondences. Now, what myth does is to give us metaphors for the process. And I would like to emphasize that because Dr. Willis Harmon, for example, who is the president of the Institute of Noetic Sciences and is an engineer by profession and a professor of engineering at Stanford University, a very interesting person whom I came to know personally last year when he visited the Crotona School. Dr. Willis Harmon has made an interesting statement, which I think I have here somewhere in connection with this, that I would like to quote more accurately. Science, he says, is not so much a description of reality as it is a metaphor for ordering our experience. Isn't that a wonderful statement? Science is not so much a description of reality. And this that we will be talking about this morning, particularly, and on perhaps this evening also, is not so much a description of reality as it's a metaphor for ordering our experience. And so we are really focusing on these two areas, becoming and being, in that sense. We are beginning to see that all of these are metaphors, and myth provides us with many of the necessary metaphors. So I'd like to look first at these 10 motifs in the cosmogonic process. These are reflected in ourselves. There probably won't be time this weekend because we can't stretch time, and, you know, here at this physical level in any linear sense. We could if we, you know, we're dealing with mythic time, then it's stretchable. But the point is that these are all reflected in us. Remember, and I won't be able to say this every other sentence, so just keep it in mind. Remember that the pattern is what we've already called the man pattern, the heavenly man. Therefore, it is all present within us. And myth points to this. And in myth, therefore, there are really three great motifs. Creation myths, and that's what we're going to look at, reflected in the hero myth. And if you're not familiar with that, there's no finer book to read than Joseph Campbell's A Hero with a Thousand Faces, which is a tremendous work. I'm sure you would have, you know it, I'm sure, Bev. Wouldn't you agree? A tremendous work, where you find these again repeated, and then in the transformation myths, the great transformation myths, which give metaphors through all the great traditions. So let us look at these because they are helpful to us in understanding the cosmogonic process, which H.P.B. summarizes in the first volume as seven essential stages. Because we are now going to have to deal, in a sense, with the realm of sequence. So H.P.B. gives it, and she says it's a kind of algebraic formula. This is how she defines it. These seven fundamental stages, which can be identified with the stanzas which she gives us. I paused there because I thought, shall I bring in something else? But then I thought, well, I have to watch time. Well, I'm going to bring it in anyway. What difference does it make? It's interesting that in the first volume, for example, she identifies these seven stages by numbering the stanzas, which we spoke briefly about last night, you remember. We spoke briefly about the stanzas of Jian last night. But she also indicates that these are only excerpts, and therefore her numbering has to do with this interior principle, if I may call it that, of recognizing specific stages in the cosmogonic process. Because here, in about shloka, stanza 5, she breaks off and says there are 11 stanzas omitted. So who knows in the original, you see, from which she was translating, how many stanzas there were. She tells us suddenly, 11 stanzas omitted. And they have to do with various things. She tells you a little bit, one whole stanza having to do with the whole planetary rounds, the creation of planetary rounds and so on. She doesn't tell us what the others had to do with. And the clue is also given in the second volume of The Secret Doctrine, in it's volume 3 of the Adyar edition, volume 2 of the original edition, where she gives further shlokas and stanzas within stanzas, but does not number them as she does in Volume 1. If you've looked at all into Volume 2, dealing with anthropogenesis, but what she gives are 49 shlokas, 7 times 7. Reflecting then these stages, these cosmogonic stages, in terms of man's own development, anthropogenesis. Well, that I throw in gratuitously. We're getting away from this. Anyway, now and then I give you a few other things. Hints may help you. All right, let's look at then some of these motifs so that you can begin to recognize them. These are, in all creation myths, they are the deepest, of course, and most important of all myths, because they touch on primary realities. And many of the elements, of course, in some of the myths, as they have come down to us, may appear rather weird, sometimes rather abstract, often very alien to us who pride ourselves on the development of the rational mind, with its emphasis on what we think of as fact. But here are archetypal patterns that have to do with the whole process. First of all, the first fundamental motif is that always all creation myths deal with an unknown, a genuine mystery. That is to say, that which cannot be spoken of, which really cannot be spoken of. So an unknown exists. We have this, of course, in the first fundamental proposition, don't we? We have it throughout the secret doctrine, you see. We've already commented on that to some extent. This is what HPB meant in that fifth one that I've given you. The great axiomatic truth that the only eternal and living reality is that which the Hindus call Paramatman and Parabrahman. Immutable, unchangeable, beyond all language. Then, the next motif that we have to recognize is that in nearly all creation myths, there is what we can call a kind of mirror element. A mirror element, which is a kind of repeatability. What happens in the highest is mirrored throughout. This is the gold in the auriferous quartz, if you like, buried there. It's always that there is a kind of reflection possible, because that includes it. When we come to this, you will see this is why this is in broken lines, as a kind of underlying reality that is mirrored out, that exists. Here is existence standing forth, which then reflects in a reflection. So there is always this mirroring principle somehow present in the myths. It's an interesting one, and it can be seen in many forms. A repeatability, what happens at the highest level in the universal mind, let us say, is reflected in all subsequent stages of manifested existence. You can see this in some external rituals. For example, when one lays the foundation of a house or a building, and often, of course, as with this building, and with the laying, with the erection of our gate and so on, but with this building, with the TPH building, a foundation stone, a cornerstone was actually laid. One is recreating the whole world. One starts at the northeast corner. This is represented today in Freemasonry, has always been part of ancient Freemasonry. This laying of a foundation at the northeast corner to recreate the whole world. The same repetition is often found in the establishment of a town or a city. Every town repeating a cosmogonical pattern. A center is established. A center is established in every city and town, which symbolizes a new cosmos from the center. In every culture in the world, there is a new year, a certain date, which is symbolized as the new year, which means a new beginning, This may occur at different times of our calendar year. But there's always the celebration of the origin of the world itself, a new beginning. And then this is mirrored again and again. Every day becomes this. A new creation is possible. But it is a mirroring principle. And that then leads to the third motif, that the cosmogonic process is always in terms of an awakening. Either it's a deliberate awakening, an emergence from a condition which is slumbering, a quiescent state, pralaya. Sometimes it's as though by accident. In the Winnebago mythology of northern Wisconsin, the creation myth begins. In the beginning, the earth maker was sitting in space when he came to consciousness and there was nothing elsewhere. It was an awakening. He's sitting there, you see, as it were. This symbolizes this. He came to consciousness. He woke up and there wasn't anything there, you see. So what did he do? He put things there. I mean, what do you do? You put things there, don't you? You turn on the light, as it were. There's some rather amusing myths in which it seems as though the creative principle, the God, rather stumbles onto something, with creation as a rather accidental discovery. Finding something, like, you know, turning, you know, getting up in the early morning in winter in the dark and stumbling on something that you'd forgotten was there in the room. You may have had this experience, you see. And you suddenly, then you put on the light and you discover what it is, and so on. So there is an awakening. In many myths, there is the motif of the twin creators. Not always twins, but paired in some way. This may, of course, go into the deeper metaphysical position of the, for example, Kashmir Shaivism, of the Shiva Shakti, creative principle. If you're not familiar with that, Dr. Timney, one of our really great writers, I think, who added significantly to theosophical literature and put this in terms of a great philosophy, the Kashmir Shaivist philosophy, translating certain sutras which had not formerly been available to us, although there are other very excellent translations, particularly by another Indian member, Jaidev Singh. But if you're not familiar with this, the principle of this twinning or pairing, in which one may be masculine, one feminine, as in the Shiva Shakti principle. Usually they complement each other in some way. One is more active, the other more passive. As I say, one may be more masculine, the other a woman, or being possessed of a more feminine characteristics. One is a little light and the other dark or shadowy. It's interesting, in some of the myths, one is often depicted as more clever than the other, while the second one is a bit stupid, lazy, or sleepy. In one of the North American Indian tribes, and I've forgotten which one, there's a delightful story of Coyote and Silver Fox, who created by thinking. Coyote went to sleep, however, and Silver Fox did all the work. And finally, when he's got everything laid out, the whole world created, he calls on Coyote to wake up. You know, hey, see what I've done. Well, the amusing thing, of course, in the myth is that Coyote then begins to eat up everything that Silver Fox has created. Now, this is a marvelous symbol, because what do as we grow up from our state of being asleep? We eat up our world. And we even use an interesting word, which means that we do this very thing. We assimilate everything about us. And when it's all eaten up, when we have assimilated everything, we will come to this knowing. So Coyote may not have been quite as stupid as you think. He was the active one, really, in terms of the creative process. In Indian mythology, it's Kali, the dark goddess, time, that eats up creation. In Greek mythology, it's Kronos, time, who eats up creation. That is to say, assimilates the world. And a variation of this myth, a motif of two creators, is sometimes found in myths that speak either implicitly or explicitly of a third who remains in the sky and does not take part in creation at all. This mysterious third underlying it, you see. Now this, incidentally, if you look at number 4 on your Principles of the Secret Doctrine, this again is page 2, you will note that HPB refers to this. She says, moreover, in occult metaphysics, there are, properly speaking, two ones. The one on the unreachable plane of absoluteness and infinity, on which no speculation is impossible, and the second one on the plane of emanation. The former can neither emanate nor be divided, as it is eternal, absolute, and immutable. The second, being, so to speak, the reflection of the first one, for it is the Logos, or Ishvara, in the universe of illusion, can do all this. So here is another way of pairing, you see, two ones. Metaphysically, in the occult doctrine, there are two ones. Now another motif which we have as the fifth, I hope to get through this before we break for a little coffee break and move about. The fifth one is the motif that I call the Deus Faber. That is the creative principle as artisan, architect, creates, pursues the whole cosmogonic process on the analogy of some skill, Faber, to make. We have this very much in Egyptian mythology, where the god Ptah is said to have created the world on a potter's wheel. And this concept, of course, of an architect is very present in the Masonic tradition. Another image that is frequently used is that of weaving or spinning. In one of the earliest commentaries on the Rig Veda, which is the oldest of the Vedas, of course, it is said that God wove the earth from primeval matter. In the Secret Doctrine, the web of the universe is woven. As weaving, of course, is usually associated with feminine activities, this motif is normally found in the myths in which the feminine plays a very major role. For example, in Plato's Timaeus, and Plato, of course, refers to a lot of myths in his dialogues, as you know,